Heavenly Father, we pause to thank you for that really, really powerful and profound truth, that we get to be called your children because of Jesus. Thank you for the reminder that we have nothing to fear, that we can rest in your presence. I pray that we would be open and just receptive to what you want to say to us today through your word. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, feel free to have a seat. Good to see you. So several years ago over at Ohio State, any Buckeyes in the room? I didn't think so. They had this large, like oval grassy area, and there were some buildings along the perimeter of that and some sidewalks that cut through the grass to connect, you know, on either side. And over the years, as they started adding buildings along this perimeter, what would happen is the students would be walking on the sidewalk, but there's a building they want to go to over there, and so they cut off the sidewalk and start going through the grass, which you can imagine, right? And as this went on, you know, you have this beautifully landscaped grass that's getting trampled by dozens or hundreds of students each day because it's not the sidewalk's not the shortcut. And again, as they kept adding buildings, this kept happening. And, you know, you do the things that you think to do, like let's put up signs that say, please keep off the grass. Yeah, right. You could rope off the perimeter, sort of control the entry point, you know, funnel people onto the sidewalks that way. The point is, it's like herding cats. And so students kept making their own path, which essentially turned the oval into a bunch of goat paths. You know what I mean? The administration did something rather interesting and actually pretty wise. What they decided to do was, instead of fighting this, that they would just let students kind of walk the paths that they wanted to walk and create the dirt trails to the buildings. And then, you know what they did after that? Any guesses? Yes. And then they poured concrete in those places and made sidewalks. And so now, what's interesting is you actually have, in this large oval area, you have this geometric yet informal pattern. And this is something that they're actually known for. It's become kind of an iconic story in their history. I actually heard about this because I was reading a book a couple years ago, a biography of an artist named Robert Irwin. And he brought this up as that approach to a challenge as really inspiring in how he pursued his art. So in this analogy, you're the administration trying to figure out how to fix a problem. And my question is, do you ever feel like what you're doing isn't working? And you try to change it, and you end up pushing, and you end up exerting, and in some ways trying to force the change or the thing to happen in your circumstance, and it's not happening. I want to give you this morning a bit of anatomy of frustration. First of all, you have the person or the circumstance that you want to change. Maybe for you, it's a relationship challenge, an issue with your kids. The circumstance could be like a career setback, or you're looking for a better job. It might be a health issue. I don't know if you've ever been frustrated by the fact that your body doesn't do what it's supposed to do, which it used to do. Anybody else? No. Okay. Well, we can all think of situations where what I'm trying to say is life won't stay on the sidewalks, okay? And we try to force and we try to change and it isn't working. Then what we do, if you're like me or you're a person of faith, and sometimes it's in this order, we've done what we can do, that's not working. God, oh yeah. God, could you change this person or this situation? Could you please fix this? And we pray, and sometimes we get frustrated, like, why isn't it happening? God, when are you going to get around to this? Or maybe you're not a person of overt faith, and yet there are times when we all get desperate enough because of this that we throw up a prayer just in case, you know, it might work. Then, lastly, once we've done all we can do to change the situation and that doesn't work and God's not changing it, when all else fails, we might eventually pause and go, huh, I wonder if I need to change. Nah, that couldn't be it, right? I wonder if I am part of the problem and part of the trouble here. Again, probably not. Okay, well, it is one thing to feel this frustration. Do I need to change my approach to preaching? It is one thing to, never mind. It is one thing to feel this frustration with the small things. You know, like they're driving so slow in front of me. They're going to make me late. I'm losing my mind. It's another thing to have like a, you know, a bad week or to wonder, how can I get my kids to pick up their wet towels off the floor? Parents, is that like a universal thing or is that just me? You know, the students won't stay on the sidewalks. At the end of the day, big deal, because life goes on. It's another thing to wake up to a bigger crisis, to face some kind of pain or suffering that we really didn't want and we have no idea what to do with. Again, that could be an unexpected career issue. It could be significant health problems. It could be a relationship meltdown, a tragedy, a loss. I'm talking about things that lead to not a bad week, but like a bad year or decade, if you've ever had one of those. What does Jesus know about these moments? These moments of ultimate frustration, discouragement, pain, that perhaps we don't. And so if you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to John chapter 21. I actually want to go back to a passage that we looked at just a little bit over a month ago. And so if you were here then, this should sound familiar. And the reason is because I think there's so much more to this, and I want to explore it from a slightly different angle and to see what might come out of this. So as you're turning there, pulling that up, just the context, this is the ending of John's gospel. And so what's happened just before this, Jesus has risen from the dead, and he's appeared to the disciples a couple different times, always catching them off guard. So they're trying to figure out what this news means. And there's a scene in John 21 where Jesus shows up to Peter and asks Peter that famous interaction, "Do you love me?" Peter says, "Yes, Lord." There's a whole thing. Jesus reinstates, he restores Peter. He gives him a calling. "I want you to feed my sheep. I want you to shepherd the church that was going to be birthed." And then Jesus said this, and this is the part I want to look at again. Jesus says to Peter, "Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." So Jesus is predicting Peter's death. And according to church tradition, history, Peter, years later, did go on and was crucified upside down by the Romans. So Jesus was right about this prediction that Peter died for following Jesus. Now, this is important to keep in mind. Right after this, in John's gospel, there's like a few more verses. And to paraphrase, you have Peter going, "Huh, that's not fair." And then Jesus, to paraphrase, says, "Who said life was fair?" That's my version, so you're welcome to read that. And then we're done. That's the end of John's gospel. There's one final verse, verse 25, right after this scene. "Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written." What that means is that there's more that John could have said. Like, this is the abridged version that we're getting in the gospel. What that also means is that John could have ended with a different scene than he does. He could have ended with another miracle account. He could have ended with, instead of the Peter, that whole scene, he could have ended with a brilliant teaching or parable of Jesus. Instead, we believe John, under the inspiration of Scripture, ends with this bizarre prediction on Peter's life. Now, what that means is that, yes, John thought it was important for Jesus and Peter to kind of tie up loose ends, and Jesus had some important things to say to him. Bigger than that, though, is John is choosing this ending on purpose. Why? And what Christians wrestling with this throughout the centuries, the contemplatives, the mystics, the saints, what they have come to believe is John knows what he's doing, And he's telling this story because it's not just about Peter and Jesus. That there's actually a paradigm in here for all of us. That there's some truth in here about our discipleship to Jesus. In other words, there's something in this that John knows applies to each and every one of us. And so I want to show you how this little interaction is actually, it can reframe how each one of us sees our own suffering, pain, frustration, disappointment. So here we go. The first thing that believers, and again, these are oftentimes contemplatives, saints throughout the centuries, have picked up on in this, and this goes back to St. Teresa of Avila, to St. John of the Cross, to more modern day people like Thomas Merton or Richard Rohr. One of the things they point out is that according to Jesus here, Jesus seems to acknowledge, and we're trying to hold this openly, he seems to acknowledge or highlight the fact that there are two halves of life. There's a first half and a second half. Jesus breaks Peter's life into two very simple stages, and the way he says it is, number one, when you were younger. Peter, when you were young, you dressed yourself, you went where you wanted, you had agency, your life was in front of you, you followed your passions, you followed your ambition, and anything is possible. You're in the driver's seat. And then in the second stage, number two, Jesus says, when you are old. So that's how he breaks it down. Keep in mind, in the first century, the life expectancy on average was like 30s or 40s. That's it. Like my age. Old, right? Now some of you are like, yeah, that does seem pretty. So that's the average life expectancy. And he gets to the second half of Peter's life and he says, you're going to stretch out your hands. Someone else will lead you where you don't want to go. You'll have less and less control. The arc of your life as you age is going to go more and more toward the cross. Again, first and second halves of life. The point being that somewhere between these two, there's a shift that happens in our posture, the way that we live in the world, the way that we experience our life with Jesus. And that this shift, it's not even a Christian paradigm. I mean, it is. But it's actually much bigger than that. It's true regardless. Other thinkers talk about the first and second mountain. Carl Jung coined the phrase, the two halves of life. So this comes up again and again. There's a whole category in psychology called stage theory, which I won't get into because I'm not a psychologist. You're welcome. What I'm going to do instead is stick to what Jesus says and how that's been interpreted, what this framework means for all of us. And so, again, don't just take my word for it or the fact that this is a really big thing we're getting into, but I want you to see if this is true to your own experience and where you are as well. So there are some things that are generally true for most of us. We'll do the first half first. In the first half of life, for probably most of us here, and I've got to be very general with this, you understand, most kids are generally happy, content, secure. I mean, unless they've grown up with, right, unless there's abuse or some really terrible home situation, most kids are resilient and for the most part happy. And we start to grow up and we hit puberty and suddenly we have this drive to go out into the world. But before that, you know, it's like home is mom and dad and I want to be home, and like our 10-year-old daughter still is convinced she never wants to leave. She wants to live with us forever. Okay, that's fine. That will change, right? And so with puberty comes not just the change in your body and the ability to reproduce. With that, I'm talking a wider sexuality, the wider part of that. It's this drive to go out and to make new friends and to explore the world and experience independence. We have this need to self-differentiate. Right? We want to make a mark in the world. That's kind of what the point is. We want to contribute in some meaningful way. And so eventually we leave home. And for some it's college. For some it's the first job or first apartment or whatever. And we live on our own. And some sociologists call these the Odyssey years, like college or probably now extended in our 20s. And this is when we discover who we are. We discover our calling in the first half of life. And this isn't just modern. If you go back to like the first page of Genesis, it says, then a man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife. And again, that, some people are here and they want to be married and they're not. Other people are here and you don't want to be married. The point is, going back to the beginning of like history of humans, we have this impulse. We have this drive to go out and to succeed and to climb the mountain and to accomplish and to find out that we are capable and see, I am worthy of love. And along the way, we encounter setbacks and failures and frustrations for sure. We make mistakes. Turns out not the whole world thinks I'm a precious, lovely snowflake like my mother, right? So we have to deal with that reality. But again, it's this discovery. And for the most part, our overhead in the first half of life is fairly low. And so what that means is generally speaking, we kind of bounce back. We tend to land on our feet. Jesus says to Peter, when you were young, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. Some of you are in this season, or you're just beginning in some ways. In the first half of life, everything seems like it's out in front of us. It's a good feeling, isn't it? This feeling of, and again, it could be after high school, my life's going to begin. Or after college, I'm really going to get this. Or when I finally settle down, it's this sense that our whole life is really out in front of us. During the first half of life, we learn to make our faith our own. Because maybe you've been handed a particular faith from your parents. So we learn to make that our own. We learn about our families, don't we? And we learn that we got some good things from them. And then there's some other things we want to try to shake off. Good luck with that. That was a cough I got from my dad. Anyway, I can. And then at some point we enter midlife. And this could be in our 30s, 40s, 50s. I don't mean this in a, you know, I don't mean like when does the yardstick of your life flip over? Because we don't know, right? But there is a moment when that happens. I mean it more in terms of like the stage that you're in and the experiences that you've had. At some point, we move from who will I become to this is who I became. And that can be underwhelming at times. Anyone? If you're like me, and probably no one in this area, like when you're young, or when you're making this, when you're young, you do something called age math. Do you guys know what age math is? I'll tell you. Age math, and this could be just an Enneagram 3 thing, I don't know, but it's when you look at where you are in life and what you've accomplished, and then you look at somebody who's older than you, who's like done, who's wildly successful beyond your wildest dreams, and then you find out how old they are in relation to you, and you can't really win the game, but here's how you feel better about yourself. The more distance there is, the more time that you have to catch up to them, the better you feel about yourself. Anyone do that ever, age math? Well, what happens is you do that for a long time, and then at some point, usually right around here, you start doing age math, and then it's backwards. They're younger than you. Or you stop caring, or you realize, I don't have time. Like Alexander the Great conquered the known world by the time he was 32. I'm past that, right? At some point, we just go, forget it. It's too late. One day we wake up and it's like, here's what I am. I'm just tired. Here's where I am in life. A whole bunch of responsibility. That's like my life. And it's exhausting at times. And it begins to dawn on us. Our life is good, but it's not all that we'd hoped it would be. We have a sense of being let down. We have some regrets. We have some real failures. Perhaps a relationship wound or two or three. And what we discover in this transition phase is that our relationships aren't as thrilling as they are in the movies. Do you realize like all romantic comedies for the most part end in the first half? That's where the movie ends. whether or not they're in their 20s or their 60s. It's the honeymoon stage is when it ends. And in our quiet desperation, which, by the way, I think is perfectly captured. There's an old ad campaign where it basically has people going, you know, I didn't do this or that amazing exotic thing that would make all my friends jealous. Instead, I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express once. Man, how on the nose is that? And we just go, oh, that's, boy. Oh, here's what I'm trying to say. At some point, we move from the first half of life, which is climb the mountain, succeed, accomplish, do great things, make a name for yourself. I'm going to take what's mine if I have to carve it from the earth with my bare hands. And at some point, it becomes, which loyalty card gives me the most points? Yeah. Ronald Rollheiser, a Catholic writer, I like how he puts it. It's a long quote, but just get ready. Moreover, and you can guess where I am, by the way. Moreover, once the sheer pulse of life so strong in us during our youth begins to be tempered by the weight of our commitments and the grind of the years, more of our sensitivities begin to break through, and we sense more and more how we have been wounded and how life has not been fair to us. New demons then emerge: bitterness, anger, jealousy, and a sense of having been cheated. Disappointment cools the fiery energies of our youth, and our enthusiasm for life begins to be tempered by bitterness and anger as we struggle to accept our limits and make peace with a life that now seems too small and unfair. I like this part. Where we once struggled to properly control our energies, we now struggle to access them. Where we once struggled not to fall apart, we now struggle not to petrify. Where we once struggled with Eros, the god of passion, we now struggle with Lyssa, the goddess of anger. And where our sympathies once were with the prodigal son, they now are more with his older brother. As we age, we begin more and more to struggle with God. Aren't you encouraged this morning? We wake up oftentimes in this midlife, and we have questions and doubts, and we're evaluating everything. And in some ways, we get to the top of the mountain, which is good. We experience some success, only to realize it's not what we thought it would be. Thomas Merton, to paraphrase, he said this thing about how oftentimes in the first half of life, we're climbing the ladder of success, and we get to the top, yay! And then we realize it's leaning against the wrong wall. The opening line of Dante's Inferno, which, by the way, is less about hell and more about an internal, inner journey, it opens with this line: midway in life's journey, I found myself in a dark wood having lost the way. So, for all kinds of reasons, many people never make it past this, to the second half. And again, we're not talking about age. We're talking about approach and posture and openness. And the reason is because to move into the second half, we actually have to do some things differently. The things that we do to climb this mountain, which are good, don't actually get us the second part of the journey. The first half of life, it's all about doing. It's all about checking things off the list. The second half is oftentimes much more about who we are. In a lot of ways, the first half is black and white. This is it, the next thing. The second half, there's more ambiguity. Or fewer things are more important to us than used to be. The first half is often linear, the second, non-linear. In the first half, we really spend a lot of time, a lot of us, comparing ourselves to others. Am I okay? Am I doing this right? Am I okay? The second half, we begin to listen a little more closely to our own journey and what God has given us and what he's calling us uniquely to do. And I could go on and on. The first half is really important. We need both halves, so it's not like this is better than that. In fact, I don't think it does a whole lot of good to go to a 22-year-old and to say, it's about being, man. Right? Because it's like, no, I got stuff I got to do. I got stuff I got to accomplish. And then it takes time for us to be open to hearing that and the journey along the way. Again, the point is that the first half successes are not what sustain us in the transition or in the second half. Jesus says to Peter, when you are old, someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. How do we begin the second half, Matt, you ask? It's not by getting old. Do you know what often prompts this, if we're open and if we're willing? It's pain. That's the story with Peter, right? It's stuff that he didn't want to happen. It's things that we haven't asked for and that we don't want. And that could be pain caused by others. It could be suffering brought on because we live in a broken, fallen world and things are jacked up. It could also be because of pain brought on by our own choices, by our own sin or failure or wounds in our lives. And so the second half of life, cue a profound spiritual lesson here, ready? The second half of life is all about acceptance. It's not about what can I get. It's not about how can I prove to the world this, that, or the other. It's not about I'll feel okay when I get a certain level of success or a certain level. What happens is maybe the greatest thing that can happen is early on you actually get those things. And then we discover there's got to be something else. And as we lean into this, because of, again, pain or suffering or things we don't want, we actually have to come to a very quiet place inside where we have to listen to God. Who do you say I am? We have to hear God say, I love you for who you are, and all that stuff doesn't matter. It's a place of profound acceptance, which then begins to free us to be of service to other people in a different kind of way. Again, St. Teresa of Avila, she said that the mark of Christian maturity, the highest degree of maturity is this. How can I be helpful to others? Not to make a name for myself, not to get accolades, but because I've been given this gift. How can I be of service to others? Now, this is hard, especially if you're in the first half of life, because you're going, come on, the clock's ticking. How is this helping me get ahead? Or, ugh, that sounds really depressing. I hope that doesn't happen to me. And if you're in the middle, or you're in the second half of life, it's really easy to look at like college students and to go, wait till they find out that being a freshman in college isn't the hardest thing in the universe. Perception is reality, and so we honor your pain and your difficulty. I'm just saying we have a different perspective once we've kind of landed there. Here's another way of saying it. Jesus says to Peter, when you're young, in the first half, the world is your oyster. You can kind of go after what you want, and you can follow your ambitions, you can follow your dreams. And in a lot of ways in doing this, you have lots of gods, little g, right? And God is sort of like a gift. As you move into this second phase, as you move into this, you realize Jesus is the only God, and everything else is actually the gift. And sadly, many people never go on the second journey. It takes a ton of courage to do this. It takes a lot of courage to move down into the valley and to not be bitter, to not give in to resentment, because the only way forward to the second mountain is down. And what some people do is we get stuck right around here, or even worse, we try to go back. I got to get back here to the first half of life. I try to recreate sort of the honeymoon. I don't mean in a marriage. I mean just like the honeymoon season of life where everything is exciting and it's an adventure. And there's nothing more sad than a person in their 40s, 50s, or 60s trying to relive, like refusing to go forward. Does this make sense? And God help a person who has money to burn at this season. Because we just perpetuate this, and we go round two, round three, whatever it takes, and we never learn the lesson. Why I really wanted to bring this up was because if you're in the middle, if you're tired, if you've achieved some degree of success from this, and you found yourself in a place going, now what? If you've woken up disoriented because you're in a season of disorientation, if you've experienced disillusionment, that life hasn't turned out like you thought, if you don't know there's this journey that Jesus knows about, that he alludes to, then the tendency when we kind of begin this descent is to despair, to feel stuck, to feel frustrated. The only way to the second mountain is through this valley of the unknown. You can't go back. I would also submit to you, I heard a speaker the other day say, I would submit to you for your consideration that the people that you most respect and admire who are older than you are people who've got to this point and kept going. And there's a wisdom, there's a peace, there's a maturity that's the only way that you can get there. There are incredible rewards for those who go forward with a posture of surrender and acceptance. Now I want to show you something else that's in this. And this is for all of us, no matter what stage or season that we're in. And again, there's this ancient wisdom in this interaction. Notice the verbs that Jesus uses. When he talks about Peter when he's young, he says, active verbs, you dressed yourself and you went where you wanted. That's the active verbs. And then when you're older, Peter, someone else will dress you and will lead you where you do not want to go. Passive verbs. That is often true for us. And what Christians throughout the centuries have had a much better understanding of is passive is not necessarily a bad, terrible thing. They don't mean passive like spineless. We're so first half of life oriented and action oriented, it's hard for us to actually hear this. And say, no, there's a place for active and passive spirituality. Active spirituality, those are all the things that we do to engage, right? And the feeling is we're doing something, and that's not to take away from grace. As Dallas Willard put it, to paraphrase, grace is opposed to earning. It's opposed to earning, not to effort. Did you catch that? And so active spirituality is the effort, at least that's what it feels like to us, that we put into things like spiritual disciplines and prayer and Sabbath and coming to church. This is an active part of our faith. It's when we see a therapist to work through, family stuff or whatever it is. It's joining a small group. These are all the things that we do to participate in our relationship with God. These are good. You don't get very far if for example, it's you come to church and that's it. Right? So there's a place for that. We need active spirituality, and we never mature to a place where we've moved beyond that. But there's also, again, drawing out from this story, a place for passive spirituality. This is the stuff that it feels like you're not doing anything. That it's actually God working in you, and oftentimes it's through pain, it's through things that we don't like or don't want and haven't chosen for ourselves. It feels like God is in charge, not us. I think of Jesus in the garden. And what's he say? I don't want this. I don't want the cross. It's not my choice, but God, your will be done, not mine. And he has this posture of surrender, of openness. And what we see in that story and what we've all experienced, hopefully, is that God does some of his best work in our pain and in our suffering. In fact, he's so good at using your pain that we actually make the mistake sometimes of blaming him for it. He's so good at coming alongside and making good out of that that we get it backwards. We go, he must be causing this. Again, passive and active. Both parts are to be a part of our lives at every stage. We never mature beyond that, and we need this. And you don't have to be old to experience this. Right? There are people in their 20s who go through pain and suffering and learn to surrender in ways that people in their 60s perhaps haven't done so yet. Our responsibility in this is to be open and to welcome God's work with trust and joy rather than anger and resentment. So again, it's about acceptance. And the only way we're able to move into a second half of life is oftentimes through pain, as God matures us, as he does the deep work and we confront our habits of sin and our wounds and our brokenness and ways we've messed things up. By the way, acceptance doesn't just mean you roll over and play dead. That's important. And part of acceptance is I'm going to do everything that's within my power to change, to, you know, whatever the situation is. But when I can't, when I'm out of options, we say, God, help me accept. God, help me accept this body that you've given me. I mean, we get real specific, right? Help me to accept this is my story. These are my weaknesses. This is my Enneagram number. Astrology for Christians, by the way. Kidding. I'm joking. Help me to accept this. Help me to accept my family of origin, my mistakes, background, all that. St. Teresa again says, let nothing disturb you. This is what acceptance looks like, by the way. Let nothing disturb you, nothing frighten you. All things are passing. God is unchanging. Patience gains all. Nothing is lacking to those who have God. God alone is sufficient. What are you frustrated by right now? What or who or what in your life do you want desperately to change and you've been trying to change? Question. Where is God in that inviting me to be active? Maybe you have some idea. Where in that is he inviting me to be passive, to let go, to stop trying to force things? And in the end, God is able to do something I wouldn't have planned, I wouldn't have chosen, but he's able to create something unique and worthwhile and, in a sense, beautiful out of that. My job is to surrender. There is a very well-known prayer, and it comes from a theologian from last century named Reinhold Niebuhr. And unfortunately, this prayer, and you might know it, it actually is, it's so common, it's become almost cliche. And I want to show you it is anything but that. It's often called the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That sounds like chicken soup for the soul-ish kind of stuff. That is so profound. If you would begin praying this prayer, the clarity that this can bring, and I just want to give you one example just so that you see the potential of this, okay? You ready? Let's pick something super easy. You're driving to work. The person's really slow in front of you, and they're going to make you late. And you feel the stress. You feel yourself start to spool up. Anybody? Ooh, okay? And then you stop and you say, God, grant me the serenity, the peace to accept the things I cannot change. I don't know this person's story. I don't know. Maybe they're an older person and somebody's supposed to drive them to the doctor and they didn't. I don't know what's going on. But I can't control them. And so God, give me the serenity to accept what I cannot change. Don't you feel better already? You're going to live. You're going to get there. But let's go on. God, give me the courage to change the things I can. And here we go. This is when it gets interesting. What can I change? Matt, did you or did you not leave your house late? Did you or did you not hit the snooze button 3 times knowing you were going to be cutting it too short? Matt, did you leave your house and go to work with full knowledge that it takes 15 minutes to get there and you have allowed yourself 10? Matt, are you saying that you could have chosen differently? Are you saying you have agency and you actually could have, instead of being on your phone, you could have left with maybe even 5 minutes of extra time in case something happened? God, give me the courage to change the things I can. This is why I think the most important part of this prayer is the wisdom to know the difference. Because if you're like me, I pretty much do the exact opposite. And I have found to a point where it's a good little test for me. When I think there's absolutely nothing I could do, I can't change it, I'm helpless. It's the way it is. That usually means there's one thing I actually can do, and I'm not seeing it. And the opposite is true when I'm like, oh, I'm going to show them, and I'm going to fix this, and I got 100 reasons why I can make this better. More often than not, that's an indication that I need to let go. Dear God, give us wisdom. That was an easy example, guys. That was getting stuck behind somebody and getting frustrated. Can you imagine the layers of complexity with like our actual problems and relationships and histories and wounds and weaknesses? Again, we need help. The prayer goes on. And this is the part that people do not know for the most part, but I love this. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace. How do you get to the second mountain? By going down. Hardship, pain. Taking, as Jesus did, this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it. Trusting you will make all things right if I surrender to your will. Passive. So that I may be reasonably happy in this life. That's a second half of life prayer, isn't it? Reasonably, come on. I want all my dreams, all my hopes, everything fulfilled, my wildest imagination. Okay, so we're now in the second half of life if we're praying for reasonably happy. And that's a good thing. With in this life and supremely happy with you forever in the next. Would you stand with me? Again, I want you to be thinking of that area of frustration, the part of your life you just keep running into a wall. What do you do with that? And when are you active and when do you let go? I want us just to pray. Hopefully you're getting a sense of the depth of this. Would you just join me in whatever that is in your life, in your situation? Let's just take a moment, and I'd like to invite you to pray this first part, just the famous part, out loud with me. Would you join me? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That is a prayer that can change your life. Have a great week. It's good to worship with you all. We'll see you next time.